This afternoon, I am thrilled to have here someone who was recently on our weekly update, Warner Mendenhall, a lawyer who has always fought for the underdog. He's defended whistleblowers, fought against corruption, and he tried to stop fraud and abuse his entire career. We like that. Does he ever have his work cut out for him in the COVID era? So, Warner, the audience is yours.
Thank you.
Oh, wait, one thing. Did I mention that for those of you who came in late, we do have a microphone. We will take questions at the end, but you have to talk into the microphone or we don't get it recorded so that everybody can hear it later. So that's key. Anyway, okay.
Thank you.
It's yours.
I'll tell you what I'm not going to do. I'm not going to go too deep into my personal legal history. You can find that on the web. One of the things that's interesting to me, and I kind of realized in the last couple of weeks, just because of some of the litigation that Jeremy Friedman and I are doing, is that we forget to read parts of our Constitution constantly. And we all need to read it, and I look at it all the time. I'm always checking to make sure I got something quoted right. But the one thing I was reading, it was just 2 weeks ago, I picked it up again, and I just started from the beginning. And I read the purpose statement for the Constitution. It's in the first paragraph. Don't overlook the first paragraph. Remember who we were. These were citizens who gathered together and decided to form their more perfect union, right? And they said that the purpose of that union, the purpose of these states, the purpose of this Constitution was to secure the blessings of liberty. Secure the blessings of liberty. So anything that goes against your liberty is against the Constitution right off the bat. The other reason that this has come up for me is because we're doing a little bit of election litigation. I've actually done election litigation for a couple of decades, but we signed on for the Colorado voters who want Trump on their ballot to help them with an amicus brief. So, well, thank you. So that was things are spinning around me often, but I got a call on a Friday by a lady named Tori Maris, and she says, hey, I'd like to file something under the Ninth Amendment. I know you love the Ninth Amendment, and nobody else has even mentioned it. The Ninth Amendment's another one to look at, because even though we have these delineated rights, 1 through 8, the Ninth Amendment says, yes, but that's not all, folks. Because remember what the purpose of the Constitution is. It's to secure the blessings of liberty. So we list a few rights, but you guys have many, many, many other rights. And I think some of those rights are personally, and we've had some nice litigation over this, and that's kind of how I got started in some of the COVID litigation. The right to work, the right to own a business, the right to run your family the way you see fit. That's the Ninth Amendment stuff. It's Griswold, there's a couple of cases, there's not many. I just got criticized, I was very proud to be criticized by Larry Tribe and Erwin Chemerinsky. They may not be known to you, but they're, like the top level constitutional scholars in the country that they both said I'm an idiot. So I'm very happy to have that criticism because now we can have that conversation. Anyway, I just wanted to start off with our Constitution because we're in this country. We need to remember these things, and it's at issue in almost every single case that we do, liberty. The story, and I'm here representing Freedom Council. Catherine, would you stand up for just a minute? Catherine is co-founder of Freedom Council. And you guys at VSRF back there, would you stand up a bit, please? I want to recognize you. These ladies and a whole big crew of other people just were so instrumental in the first COVID litigation conference, in March. And I think it really brought, it was just an amazing event. Another one is coming up in Vegas. What's the date?
March 7th and 8th
in Vegas. So, the outgrowth of the COVID litigation conference in March was that these attorneys, they didn't even realize that we had a community. They're out here beating their heads against walls, suing counties, cities, states, companies, whatever, And they didn't realize that there were a lot of other people doing it. So coming out of that, Catherine and I decided to found Freedom Council. And Catherine's not an attorney, by the way. And I think that's part of the point here. Even at our COVID litigation conference, we had a whole thing on pro se litigation. What can you do? Lawyers are hard to find. I mean, they're hard to hunt. They're a rare breed, you know. So one of the things, and one of the reasons in particular, I think Catherine really brings a perspective that I don't hold very well, but it's the perspective of who are the victims, who are the people. She's constantly reminding me, what can we do? What can they do? Give them something to do. Make sure that they're empowered. So I really appreciate that insight and that push, because I'm in a little bubble. I'm suing people and, you know, I'm in this little bubble. So it's very helpful to have input from not the normal sources. So anyway, we have a Freedom Council conference. I'll explain the difference at the end here, but we have a Freedom Council conference in June in Denver as well. So we got a couple legal conferences coming up. Please attend those. I mean, it's really a great place to discuss what we can do, how we can get the job done. I've always had a very busy career and, you know, never had enough time. So when COVID hit, I was like really thankful because they shut everything down. And, you know, I'd always kind of had this dream, God, if I could just stop the world for 30 days, I might be able to get caught up, you know. Well, the courts closed, I got extensions on everything, you know, because they weren't going to have any hearings, and I had my 30 or so days. But in the midst of that, you know, my brothers own small businesses, I have friends who own bars, restaurants, you know. I'm just watching devastation in the economy, and the small businesses in particular was what I was most sensitive to, and we represent a lot of small businesses, so. And the first case we filed was in 2020 for a bar that refused to shut down when the governor told them to shut down. They lost their business, They were out, they have actually now reopened under a new license, liquor license. But we sued because who shut them down was liquor control. And I went to court, and I'm like, what's liquor control talking about health care and diseases and pandemics? That this is ridiculous. They have no authority for this. Turns out, and then I sued in a particular way called a declaratory judgment. So 3 years later, you know, appeals, everything, a lot of stuff, we lose, but not completely. One of the issues when I filed that case, everybody told me I did it wrong. Kind of like Larry Tribe. Everybody told me I did it wrong. The Supreme Court, in saying it was moot, said, no, this is how you do it. You file a declaratory judgment to determine whether or not the administrative body has that power. That is how you do it. So we have set a trail. If they shut down a business again, I'm going to point to my case at the Ohio Supreme Court. It's not my case, my client's case. But I do take a lot of ownership.
That. You know, you can do that today.
There's a couple of clients in the room here. Brooke Jackson, Angela Wolbrecht, and we'll talk about those cases a little bit too. But so that's how I got started. And then, you know, and then Catherine and I got to know each other because I was desperately reaching out, like, who's doing anything? I mean, I'm trying to find attorneys myself because to team up with and clients and everything else. Catherine's down at the state legislature, you know, and she puts the data on the screen, except she removes the timeline. And she says to the legislature, well, you tell me when this pandemic hit. You tell me when these effective masking measures, quarantine measures, you know, had any impact at all. Well, guess what? That's a perfect cross-examination because there's no way to see beyond the normal scope of an infectious disease going through the population where any of these interventions made any difference at all. So she made her point. I happened to see it. I'm like, oh, my God, who is this woman who's getting into the data like this? Because I'm not really a data guy, but I was impressed by the argument from a legal perspective. It's a perfect cross-examination. So anyway, we have since done, I'll try to watch my time here. I've got so much to talk about, and I do want to take some questions. I'm going to go through a little bit of our litigation. Oh, and by the way, Betsy, I mean, we really want to model our Freedom Council on FLCCC. You guys are doing such a great job. They really serve a model of how to exist in this space, be very, very inclusive. And
we are inclusive.
Yes.
We're all over the spectrum politically, I think you should know.
Yeah.
And that's good. But we can talk to each other. We don't spit at each other. It's amazing that you can, have a civil society but on this issue, we're all together.
FLCCC is certainly modeling a behavior. I am trying, we're trying to follow on. But I want you guys to be aware, our litigation, I would say, most of it is actually unseen. Even though we get to go to court, and the thing I love about court, and Jeremy constantly reiterates this, is, hey, we're there. We have the facts. You bring your facts, we bring our facts, and somebody's going to decide the facts. And what emerges is the truth. So the courtroom is an adversarial process that we've relied on to get to some commonality and truth in our society. Because the truth is not a fixed thing, just like science is never fixed. It's a battle. It's a battle, it's an exploration, it's experimentation, and the court allows us to do that, and we are winning those cases. We are winning probably two-thirds of the cases, maybe three-quarters nationwide, all over the place. And do you know how many cases there have been? Oh, I think we're close to 20,000 total cases. And it covers a gamut of things. It's not just vax injury or hospital injury. It's insurance and property and shutdowns and everything else. But it's 20,000 cases.
In a very short time, really.
Very short time.
Ooh.
And cases that we filed at the beginning, like that bar that got shut down, it just resolved a few months ago. Brooks' case is ongoing. It was started in 2020. I mean, this stuff takes years, unfortunately, but think about that. And the press doesn't cover it. They are not covering the victories. They are not spreading the news about how successful we're actually being. I think people feel sometimes hopeless, helpless. I mean, we're not getting anywhere. We're getting somewhere. We are getting somewhere.
Thank you.
So, there are a lot of things. So I call that unseen litigation. One of the things that really, really concerns me, I have kids and grandkids, okay? My son was in college during part of this, and he's out now. Thank God he went to California. whatever.
okay.
We have our disagreements. But one of the things that really concerns me and has concerned me, I mean, with the mandates in particular, I mean, that's been a huge, huge effort. I mean, that has been a central issue for our practice. But the educational, it's like a cattle chute. And initially, it was covered all people going into education. It was like a cattle chute. We fought it. We sued five universities in Ohio, University of California, Regents. We won. I can go into some of those victories in a minute, but and actually, 2021, right? This is ongoing. I still have university cases ongoing today. Regents is just getting fired up. I mean, but that covered all students, and we've seen all of the educational institutions for the most part. And I wish Lucia Sinatra were here, but I think we're down to 60 or 70 that still have mandates in the country. What a success!
Is the timeline in the courts normal, or do you think there's a lot of foot dragging on these cases?
Well, here's where we are. Most of the educational institutions that we sued, including school boards, by the way, they caved very quickly. And then most of the cases, the courts then ultimately ruled as moot, meaning, there's no controversy. So these educational institutions, for the most part, with this exception I'm going to talk about in a minute, they caved. They caved across Ohio, they caved across the United States. As long as you got a lawsuit in, got it filed, but it doesn't mean you won that lawsuit, or did you?
Until next time.
Until next time, yeah. We did win, but I want people to realize that by getting those things filed, by people standing up, students standing up, people resisting and just going to court, they caved. So we have some, and the issue becomes standing. After the controversy goes away, then you have a standing issue. So we are fighting hard to hold on to some. We have a few of them still going. I got a school board case, Ohio University, that case is ongoing. The appellate court told us we had standing in the Ohio University case, so we're still hanging on. Because we want them to cry uncle, right? You know, I grew up with two brothers. I mean, you fight till you cry uncle, right? That's where we're going to. So that's my background, that's my legal training. but there's an area that, I mean, you know, as a dad, it just kills me. The kids who are going into medical school, and I got a daughter who wants to go into medicine. I got friends' daughters and sons that want to go into medicine. I got friends that want to be firefighters. They want their kids to be firefighters. Well, guess what a firefighter has to do? They have to do EMT training or paramedic training. They are not letting our children get a medical education unless they agree to take a fucking shot. And I mean, I'm 62 years old. Who knows how much time I got left, but I want opportunity for these kids. I want them to be able to get their medical education and come out here and help treat this society that just made itself sick. The other thing I see in medicine is there's an access problem. If you're a salesperson for a medical device company or drug company, I'm seeing hospitals now demand that you show your vax card to get the pass that you need to get through their security systems that they set up to keep the families out, right? So they've set this, they've got these walls and security and passes and all this crap that I never had when I went to the hospital. You know, when my wife was in labor, I mean, we just walked in and out of the room. I mean, that's how it's supposed to be. And family, we all know family's healing. Love is healing. You got to have loved ones around you, or you're not going to heal. You're going to feel alone and bereft. So that access is, you know, my salespeople that we represent, we're suing Syneos Healthcare is one of them. We got a bunch of people there, but you know, this sales issue. One of the ladies in our case, this is on the public record, so I'm not giving away HIPAA information. She survived cancer 4 times. Her doctor said, "Do not take the shot." She's getting blocked from going into one of the hospitals that she's trying to serve right now. She has a medical exemption verified by a doctor, four-time cancer survivor, can't get in to do her job because of what this stupid hospital's doing. Now, that may be a lawsuit, but that's a fairly recent development, and we may sue over that because that's ridiculous. The second thing that's killing me is they've destroyed the doctor-patient relationship with all this stuff. The corporate practice of medicine is just destroying medicine right now. And I mean, I've got so many horror stories, but there's one I'm going to tell you about. They have a scribe following a doctor around the hospital. He's fired now, actually. They followed him around the hospital to see if he was recommending the vaccine, quote unquote, to the patients, and to see if he was prescribing ivermectin. The scribe is supposed to be within the HIPAA, the patient-doctor-patient relationship. The scribe was sending the notes to the administration. And then he gets disciplined. And now you got scribe AI and all this other crap. The administrations they're spying on the doctors. You guys already know this, I know, but I mean, I mean, that's corporate practice of medicine. So we're gonna take on that case. I hope you'll hear about it very soon. We're actually working on the complaint because we've got to go after corporate practice of medicine. And I guess I'm going to get into the protocols.
Is he still working there?
No, he's gone. No, he got fired. Yeah. No, he stood his ground. He's not going to change what he does. But, you know, I mean, and I get it. Not everybody can do that. Not everybody's in a position to do that. He happens to be about my age. He's had a good career. So, you know, he's floating around the country working where he can. Christopher Rake. Was a doctor at UCLA Medical Center, who some of you may know. He was walked off the campus in October of 2021. He's a very religious person, and they actually were begging him to get a religious exemption, do something, anything. You know, he would not bend the knee. He's like, you know, my religion is that I don't use my religion for stuff like this. That's my religion. So they walked him out with security off the campus, and he just said no. And he cited Nuremberg principles, experimental drugs, everything you can think about. And that was a long time ago. But the Ray case is just now firing up, and Angela's part of that as well. We have a number of lead plaintiffs, and Angela's one of them. But we're trying to represent 220,000 employees of the University of California system to stop them from mandating any medical project onto their people. And we are actually suing. We went to the belly of the beast. We're suing in county court in Alameda County in Oakland, California, under state law. Right? And you know why law is good there, and we think it's good, because the people of California are very liberal, and they voted for privacy rights and bodily autonomy and everything else. Well, and they passed a referendum. The citizens passed a referendum for privacy. It's data privacy, it's personal privacy, it's bodily autonomy. We're using what California set up. We're using the California system to beat the regents of the University of California, which are violating its state's citizens' constitutional rights under the California Constitution. And then, and likewise, our five lawsuits in Ohio were all under the Ohio Constitution, under state law, no federal law. The federal courts, there's different standards. Sometimes it's more complex, but we're winning in under state law, and I hope we're going to win this one under state law. So Jeremy's my wonderful co-counsel sitting over there with Brooke Jackson. Thank you so much, Jeremy. Stand up, Jeremy. Come on. So Jeremy and I have been friends for a long time, 23 years maybe? Is it that long? We both are False Claims Act lawyers. That's how we got to know each other at first. The next thing that I want to say is that we recognize that, you know, people don't realize what their rights are. We're dealing with that every day. You know, and if you file, and it starts at the application for a job. If you file an application for a job and you've got, say, a religious belief that you shouldn't take the shot, and they discriminate against you, you have a case. You can file with your local human rights organization at the state. In Ohio, it's called the Ohio Civil Rights organization. At this federal level, though, you can file with the Equal Employment Opportunity Commission, the EEOC. You can file it online. You know, use these, and I swear to God, it's unbelievable how many people don't seem to know that these processes are out there. But it's for us to use. Our taxpayer dollars pay for it. And guess what? The EEOC has supported some of these cases recently. And I think it's because we embarrass them, actually. Rachel Rodriguez, who practices out of Florida, found through a FOIA that they had set up a special office, and they got the information to deny all the EEOC complaints, and it had to be reviewed in D.C., not locally. Well, as soon as she finds that, I mean, we're on the phone. I mean, I want to sue the EEOC. I'm like, this is great. Let's go get them, these bastards. Well, they changed their policies and, in fact, submitted a brief supporting an employee who had been fired, and we're relying on the EEOC's brief now. It's unbelievable. So our work, your work, everybody's work, to dig and find out what they're doing, it's friggin' embarrassing what they did in the background. Portsmouth gaseous diffusion plant in southern Ohio, the steel workers are down there. You know what we found down there? That there was $1 million incentive for the company to get its workforce to 90% vaccinated. And as soon as we found that, guess what happened? The mandates went away. These are federal nuclear energy employees and contractors. It went away. We filed a TRO in federal court in Columbus, and, oh, they mooted it. So we recovered it. That case alone recovered 170 jobs. Like, boom. And we actually have a couple that were moving on. But I will tell you, in the midst of that battle, you know, we had been contacted by the employees, you know, and there were some people, there was a young, relatively young guy in his 40s. You know, he was part of the group that had formed. And I hate to tell you, but you guys already know the story. He's not with us anymore. He didn't feel like he could stand up and, you know, be fired over this lawsuit. He got the shot and he died. So, you know, it's a killer. We also, in that group, we had a miscarriage as well, which I, you know, believe that was shot related as well. So, yeah. Woo! I'm sorry. I gotta get something to drink.
You have a slide up there. I wondered if you wanted to elaborate anything about the False Claims Act.
I'm going to. How much time? How much time do I have?
How much time do you want for questions?
Can we do like 15 minutes? So if I get 15 more minutes.
15 more minutes?
Warn me when I'm done at 15 more minutes, and I'll wrap up as quickly as I can.
Trust me.
Thank you.
Okay.
Anyway, I'm glad I have an outline. Sometimes I run without an outline. The EEOC, I just want you guys to be aware that you can make, if you're in trouble and something's happening, make the filings. Force the administrative state, that's what it is, to do its job. And you know, our group of lawyers has done an incredible amount of beautiful work on the employment side. And I can't tell you how brilliant the attorneys are that have come on board. There's, you know, 240 some of them. And by sharing our successes, our failures, our ideas, our theories, we are leveling up so fast. The arguments are getting so good. They have improved our litigation unbelievably. I mean, it's the group mind at work among these counsel. And if you know any lawyers, please send them our way. We need more lawyers. And we'll help them. We're trying to help, because a lot of us are solo, small practitioners. You know, and we need help. We need to, you know, we need people who've been down the road before, you know, that can show us where the pitfalls are and have been there. And a lot of the lawyers that stepped up are not, they're practicing out of their areas. I got domestic relations people doing employment law. I got, you know, employment law people doing False Claims Act. I got brand new attorneys doing medical malpractice. I mean, good Lord. You know, so we're trying to help level everybody up, you know, and help fill in the gaps for all of us. I mean, me included, to be frank. So, one of our cases, and I'm going to move on a little bit. So this is what we're able to do and we're trying to do for medical issues, doctors, you know, the medical students especially, you know, the medical students, I guess I forgot about that. The medical students just kill me because that's where the mandates are still in place. They got to go through this cattle run to get the shot before they get into their jobs and get their education. It's just unbelievable. The next thing that we're dealing with is, you know, I want to talk a little bit about the death by hospital cases. Mary Holland mentioned criminal issues. And we are actually, through the death by hospital cases, we're trying to build evidence that may lead to a criminal complaint. And I'll give you, we have one in Ohio, Karen Michelonis. These are all on the dockets. You can follow these cases. So Karen Michelonis, you know, here's a lady, comes in. She had COVID. She recovered from COVID, but her body was weak. She gets community-acquired bacterial pneumonia. Comes to the hospital. What treatment do you think they gave her?
Remdesivir.
COVID treatment. They have these COVID treatment protocols. She gets a COVID treatment protocol, and she's dead. So guess what? Community-acquired bacterial pneumonia is not covered by the PREP Act. You know, they misused the treatment. It's a complete misapplication of the treatment. They're not covered by that. You have a Med-Mal case. And we have experts on that case, but we need more doctors willing to write the letters of merit that we need to bring these cases when we see medical malpractice in the docket. And it's hard, or in the records. It's been very difficult, and we need doctors to step up. We have some wonderful doctors who have, though. Thank you. But we need more. I got 240 attorneys who need doctors, right? And hopefully we'll have 1,000 attorneys by the end of the year that need doctors. They need doctor experts, doctor testimony, doctor review, doctor consultation, just to understand it. I'm not a doctor. I don't understand a medical record. I mean, I do a little bit, but you know, I want you got to walk me through this. Where's the problem? You know, and we're working on systems to get that process to move more efficiently, more quickly, and especially for the doctors, I know this, if you get a 16,000 page record, we try to have it pre-reviewed by a nurse who's knowledgeable so that you don't have to deal with 16,000 pages, for example. But, you know, that's horrific what they did to her. And she was a nurse. She told them what she had. She said, I need antibiotics. She knew what was going on. Shara case is another one. You know, that's the Down syndrome child who was killed. And Scott is very adamant about this. Scott Shara, the dad, you know, they killed her and they put on a DNR without the family's, consent at all. And the key thing with the Shara case that we got through, because there was no consent for the treatment, we alleged battery. I didn't expect the battery count to win, and we won. So every case you face a motion to dismiss, which we're facing in Brooks' case, we faced it in Rake's case. But the judge said, oh no, that survives, it's battery. You know, you have enough, you've alleged enough to, say there's battery. Well, battery is not only a civil offense, it's a crime. So we're building the record. We get to do depositions. We get to get their records. We get to question them. And we get to hold them civilly accountable. But we're taking what we learn in that case, to the prosecutor. It's already there. And we've already had some initial discussions. But they want to see what we get. And then they'll make a decision then. So the other thing that's out there is Minnesota. It is amazing what's going on in Minnesota. You know, first of all, it's got a long statute of limitations, 3-year statute of limitations. So a lot of states, it's 1 year, 2 year. Minnesota's 3 years. There are a lot of dead people that need their deaths vindicated. And the Minnesota people, because of the extra time in part, and just because some really, really strong activists up there have come together as a group to attack the system, because that's what it is now, it's the death system, at their hospital. And right now, what do we have, 120 widows?
Heavens.
Yeah, okay, some survivors. 120 families. This is in Minneapolis, folks, that have come together to attack, to counterattack what these hospitals did. 20 widows from Mercy alone. So we're going to package those 20 up. And looking through the records, it's a system. We see it.
Do you have the doctors to testify?
Well, we're here looking for doctors, of course. Yeah.
I'm sitting here, though, thinking that your big problem with all of this is pharma basically owns the doctors because the ones that speak out know that what's going to happen to them could well be what happened to Pierre Corey and Paul Marrick.
Yeah.
And they've got children in college and debts and da-da-da-da and
I'm glad you raised that. I mean, look, the brave doctors that have come forward to testify and help and be public about what's going on, I mean, they've also, everybody knows what's happened to Meryl Nass and what's going on there. Renata Moon, I heard, and maybe somebody can confirm that she just won her case in Washington. I heard that. Is that true? Oh, fantastic. Oh. So these battles can be fought, and I provided a slide deck. I'm not going to go over it. It's 78 pages of slide deck about what you guys face in the medical licensing arena. And Alan Dumoff, who represents Pierre, that's his slide deck. Okay, he provided it to me, for whatever I wanted to use it for, and I wanted to make sure you guys had it and knew the name. Alan Dumoff, and he actually has come to our free, we have a weekly meeting and we have some briefings for the lawyers that are all internal, none of it's public, but Alan's training lawyers how to defend the doctors. Alan's toward the end of his career, he's helping us know, helping us learn what does it take, and we got attorneys who want to defend you guys. If you're in trouble, we want to defend you. Those battles have to take place. So we've got some very bright counsel that is, you know, some have already done it. I mean, one of my partners, Tom Connors, you know, he represented doctors for 30 years. You know, he's toward the end of his career, but I mean, we are trying to gear up. Pete Serrano in Washington with Silent Majority Foundation. That's a motivated young man. You know, and he's ex-military. I mean, there's a group of ex-military at COVID litigation. They're all lawyers. These guys are ready to charge the hill. I mean, I'm telling you. So I like the military mindset. And then a lot of military, of course, we know what's happened there. That's a cattle chute too. Yeah. You know, we've lost a quarter million or more of our armed forces over this crap. And you guys know what's happening. At the hospital, one of the hospitals we represent, 200 nurses were fired. We're still, you know, we have that lawsuit ongoing. But that losing 200, losing 250,000, that's the margin between a functional hospital or a functional military. Hate to tell you, but our national defense is trashed right now. You know, we take the best and the brightest, the most aggressive, the most, you know, the most ethical, and we look at their records too. People come to me. That's the thing that amazes me too. They're pristine. These people, these military men and women, these doctors, these nurses, they're pristine. There's no discipline. There's no drug use. There's no affairs at the office. They're pristine. They're religious, spiritual, strongly committed people. It's exactly who we need in our society, in our hospitals, in our military, and every other institution that's out there. And that's who we're going after. But we're becoming an army, I guess, because we have to.
5 minutes.
Five
before
minutes.
Questions.
Okay. So one of the beautiful things about Scott Shara and I think Minnesota shows, not so much the McAlonis case, but remember that criminal prosecution is political. Right? It's political. Don't ever forget, it's political. We elect prosecutors or district attorneys or whatever you call them. We elect mayors and other people who are in charge of our justice system. It's political.
And pharma can buy them too.
Well, not so much locally.
Okay.
They're not invested yet locally. Okay. We might trigger a lot of donations for a lot of prosecutors real quick here, but it's political. Remember to, first of all, get to know them. Get to know who's running for your prosecutor and ask them when they're going to hold them accountable. The second thing that's happening in Minnesota and Shara is media attention. It's tremendous media attention. It's political. What do they pay attention to? They pay attention to, oh, that's starting to look embarrassing when I got 20 widows at one hospital. All of them had the same protocol and all their husbands died. Oh, that's a problem. And it's on there. It was on the CBS local news. Scott Shara, you know, he's done his own effort, miraculous effort to, you know, spread the news. He's got billboards all over Wisconsin, you know, talking about his daughter. You know, I mean, that's the level of commitment. But that's what it's going to take to get attention and to get some criminal prosecutions going. The other thing that's possible out there, there are some special statutes in states, particularly in the progressive states of Wisconsin, Minnesota. Think back to the early 20th century, that you have a separate mechanism. You can go to a judge and ask for a probable cause finding for a criminal charge. So we're actually in those processes too. And then there's some citizen grand juries that actually have been meeting. We got one of our people got on one of those citizen grand juries that you can form independent of the justice system. He did misbehave a little bit. He got so upset he got ejected. You know, he did manage to get one formed and get on it. And I mean, that's like, it's a try, it's an effort. And we're learning from these efforts because these are institutions and ideas and laws that are in these states. We haven't used them. We didn't think we need them. But we were a frontier looking country. We have some frontier mechanisms. This is frontier justice, it really is, but in the best sense of it. We as citizens had to come together to figure out how to deal with crime in our communities and people who did things. So some of these laws are still in the books from 100 years ago, 200 years ago. Just pay attention to those, and they're coming up. So I think I've gone over the help that we need too, maybe not too much, but we need records review, letters of merit. We need billers, pharmacists, expert witnesses, vax injury. I got to keep going a minute.
You got a minute.
Okay.
Go.
We're trying to figure out a way, and I use the False Claims Act in a lot of things. This slide will be available to you guys. Who can be a defendant? You see that? So what we're doing on this is we're using the False Claims Act to turn the tables on the hospitals. Do you know there is a vaccine provider participation agreement? This is just one example of many. They're mandatory reporters. Just like if a child came in all beat up, right? They got to report it. They got to report it to the police, the child services, whatever. They are mandatory reporters under the False Claims Act, under the provider participation agreement. And there are civil and criminal penalties, federal criminal penalties to fail to report to VAERS. Just be aware of it. And
I didn't know.
Huh?
Yeah. I didn't know that.
It is considered hiding information from the federal government that you're required to turn over, and it actually falls under the lie statute, 18 U.S.C. 1001. Failure to say things sometimes can be a lie. We kind of all know that in our personal lives. failure to say something can be a lie, right? That same thing is true under the VAERS system. So we can turn, and the liability is per... Let me give you the simplest idea, and it's a little more complex. There's a lot of things we can talk about. If you get COVID after you've had the shot, that's a reportable event to the VAERS system. And it's a violation not to report it by your pharmacy, by your hospital, by your employer, wherever you got your shot. It's a violation for any program participant. It's a violation of the False Claims Act. It's a violation of criminal law. They are mandatory reporters if they're not doing it, and I know they're not because I got nurses that were fired for trying to make reports. So it's mandatory, and that's a way to turn it on them. And we can turn the victims on the hospitals, and we're actually working on the system right now to gather victims, like pick a hospital. Find 10 victims, people who got COVID or had some adverse event, gather them together, file a False Claims Act case. Now, you can't do that without an attorney. I will say that attorneys are actually mandatory in that process. They don't let civilians do that. It has to be an attorney. But we've got attorneys we're training on how to do this. And we have a model complaint that we provided to all the attorneys so they can do it. Last 2 points, and then I'll get on. Funding. I'm not good at asking for funding, but we need funding. You can imagine if we've got just 20 malpractice cases against one hospital, how much funding that takes, right? It's a lot. It's a couple of million bucks, really, to fund that case. Chris Rake's case with 200,000 plus employees at the University of California system, we're going to really massively need the data there. Brooke's case, we're at motion to dismiss stage. If we survive that, we're going to be in discovery against Pfizer for the lies and cheating that they did to get this thing through the FDA. Yeah. So listen, these cases are absolutely critical. If Brooke case goes through, it's fraud. Guess what? The statute of limitations for fraud is long. It's also a crime. By the way, that would open them up. It would get rid of the PREP Act. So please help us. Let's get rid of the PREP Act. That's one way to do it. Yeah. There's other ways to do it, and those are going. But this is a key case. They committed fraud. That's what we've alleged. I think I just defamed somebody. We've alleged that they've committed fraud, and we have the evidence, and it's in court, and we're trying to get past a motion to dismiss right now. In Chris Rake's case, we need to get the data from the University of California system, which was engaged in this experiment, has all kinds of research going on this shot and the consequences. We need to get them. We need to get their data. We got past the motion to dismiss. So now we get discovery. We're into the discovery case on Chris Rake and Angela's case. We're in discovery phase right now. Good Lord, they have to give us documents.
I think we need to do questions, but because you're such a good guy and doing such good work, and because the next session in the ballroom does not start until 2:00, we'll just go to 5 minutes of.
Yeah, well, I don't care. I mean, whatever.
I'm here. All right. Well, that gives
last
you
thing,
that gives you
I got
more
my
time.
I got my list. I'm trying to get through. Last thing on my list is conference. There's the COVID Litigation 2 conference in March, and then there's going to be a Freedom Council. Oh, I did say I was going to differentiate that a little bit. Because we're training and trying to get everybody together, and the attorneys are working with each other, what happened is we're starting to get in other areas of law as well, beyond COVID. So obviously, I'm in election law area. We're in, a friend of mine just got, looks like he's going to get hired to go defend a clerk in Arizona here, who's being charged criminally. Some of you may know about that, because she was investigating the election fraud in Arizona. Well, they have charged her criminally. I believe her name's Tina Peters. Do you guys know that? People are reaching out to us all over the place to help in all kinds of ways. We got the central bank digital currencies that are going to have all kinds of liberty implications. We've got all these elections. We've got to get our elections straight. This fight started with COVID, but it needs to end in freedom and needs to restore our Constitution. That's what we're about, and that's a long battle.
So, we must have some questions out there. We do have a mic right up here behind the first table, so please come and stand at the mic if you have a question, because we want everything on the record here, on the recording. Yes.
So, Doc, working in Richmond, but a patient in state of Washington, pharmacy refuses to fill prescription, patient dies for lack of, in this case, ivermectin and a 10-day duration of missing. Recovery, what's the address to such a problem where pharmacies, I mean, in this case, 4 or 5 different commercial pharmacies refused a physician order?
Well, I mean, there's a lot of issues there. So the physician themselves has a potential lawsuit. The death, I mean, we got to have a lot of detail on that, though we do have an ivermectin case that one of our attorneys has filed, one of the Freedom Council attorneys, not my firm, but one of the Freedom Council attorneys has filed. So we are exploring exactly that issue in other cases. Here's what I want to say. You know, just being down here, we're going to have an open meeting the third Thursday of every month. And I don't know what time you guys would like to have that available to you, but we're going to have an open meeting where anybody can come with any issue like that, and we're going to have lawyers on that meeting, and any doctor, nurse, whoever wants to show up. So we're going to have this third Thursday meeting dealing with these issues so that we can continually address questions to the extent that we can. I don't know everything. We don't know everything. But the other thing that would provide us, it gives us a heads up. It gives us an early warning signal as to what's happening in the community, right? What's happening at this college or that college? What are the medical students having to do now? What college has reinstituted some other kind of controls on the students? You know, we need an early warning system. The third Thursday meeting is going to help provide that. We're already doing this just on the legal side with the attorneys. Every Monday we meet. It's not recorded. You just open it up to whatever anybody brings, and we get a real sense of what's happening with all the litigation nationally from those meetings, and what's the current concern. I want to do the same thing, but you know, to have a medical-legal opportunity to do that. So we're figuring that out, but we already decided third Thursdays it's going to be there. We're going to just start doing it and see what happens. That's what we did with the attorneys. It's turned out to be a wonderful thing. So we're going to try to replicate that more on the medical side, focused on that. Because we do a lot of employment, false claims, other things. But go ahead.
Could you go through some of the implications of Brooks' case if it's successful? Like, could this actually get rid of the liability protection from
yes.
Pfizer?
Yeah, of course. I mean, that's the whole point. It's fraud. We prove fraud, they're done. They're also bankrupt. I mean, technically the penalties on the case are, I think they're growing now. I think we're up to $4 trillion.
Yeah.
So, yeah. Pfizer doesn't have $4 trillion, obviously, but it would force them into bankruptcy. They have some intellectual property we might be able to parcel out to some new companies with some ethical behavior. But their intellectual property, what they do, they go into bankruptcy. If we were to win, it breaks them up and it spreads their intellectual property all around. People can buy it. Go ahead.
Hi. I'm a physician and I did pulmonary critical care through all of this COVID stuff. And I was fortunate enough that I did work at an institution where they allowed me to do the FLCC protocol, but not without grief, for sure.
Wow.
But through all of that, there's nothing I want more than justice. Justice for the patients, justice for the doctors that suffered, justice for the unvaccinated people who were shamed and denied surgeries or transplants, or people not being able to come in and see their families. I told Senator Ron Johnson, we need to never let that happen again, where we shut down the hospitals and no one is allowed in to see their families. I used to have to beg administrators to please let in a child to see their father in the ICU, not doing well, confused and agitated, and all we needed was a family member to just come in there and calm them down instead of giving them drugs after drugs after drugs. But I would love to offer my services to Freedom Council to review charts, to do whatever I need to do. And I'm still on the plane, I'm reading through LSAT books thinking I want to go to law school. My son is at Nebraska right now, and he wants to attend law school, and I have him fired up, and I'm thinking, you know, in 3 years, buddy, when you go, maybe I'll go with you. Woo!
From a legal career perspective, I got to tell you, and you guys probably get the sense, I mean, I've got sadness, I got all kinds of things I got to deal with, but I also have joy in what I'm doing. This is the most interesting litigation I've ever done in my life. And we're doing everything we can to work out the structures and methodologies to hold people accountable. And we're litigating the refounding of the country, basically. Our litigation refounds the country, and that's what we're doing. What more exciting thing to do than to, you know, read the first paragraph of the Constitution and try to apply it, right? That's, oh man, you know. So I'm so sorry, and you guys saw me. I mean, and it hits me. I cry at the weirdest times, just because we get, you know. And I'm a guy. I mean, I had brothers. You don't cry, but you know, I deal with, you know, it is really hard to deal with. You know, every day we're hearing about death. You know, I mean, I'm thinking of one right now. That 6-year-old girl died this week after getting some shots. So, my grandbabies are 3 and 2, so you see where I am. And I was on the phone with my daughter. I mean, she's, you know, I beat her ear, but after that happened, I was like, listen, her youngest is going into preschool. I said, look, you do not let them tell you that child has to have a vaccine to go to that preschool. And Ohio does have a pretty good structure. We know how to fight in Ohio, and I can get her into the pub. It's a public school. It's a good public school, but I know they're going to come up with the vaccine requirements. So, you know, after that, I mean, I was like, man, I was on the phone with my wife, and I'm telling her about this. I'm like, oh, my God. You know I've beat my daughter's ear about this, but I'm conferencing her in. This is killing me. You know, you know, I mean, as parents, you know, I guess we put ourselves out there because, you know, gosh, if we lost a child, it's just devastating. I'm going to share a little bit. We did lose a child at birth. Mm-hmm. So it touches me very deeply. Mm-hmm. And I cannot imagine losing your child. So. It's a while ago, but you never get over it.
No, not like that.
You never get over it.
So my dad used to tell us every time, you know, when we'd go, why, Pop, why? And he goes, well, you're dealing with people that say, please don't confuse me with the facts. Yeah. So I have a question regarding precedent law. How does precedent law act in your favor or not in your favor? And then also, when is Nuremberg 2.0? Is this real or not real? Are we going to institute it?
Listen,
and where is it governing in today?
Yeah, well, listen.
And do you know Seth Keschel?
Do I know who, what?
Seth Keschel.
I don't know.
He is a statistician that used to be in the military, and he's traveled the United States trying to document fraud in all the counties.
Let's make the connects.
Okay.
Yeah, please. Very good question. California, in its state legislation, has the Nuremberg Code in it. They passed it specifically. So guess what's in our case? The Nuremberg Code. Now, we're fighting about it right now. It was one of the things that the judge doesn't like, but she gave us a chance to amend. We're trying to adjust to get that in our case. Beyond the privacy issue that I just talked about, we are also going after what's called jus cogens. It's the international standard of morality and law that is independent of constitutions, that this is simply, you know, so bad, so obviously bad, that it's an international standard that's been violated by the University of California. So that's, we are trying, we're fighting on that issue right now to get Nuremberg in that case. It's not, she's dismissed it, but she gave us a chance to amend. That's where we are on that. Go ahead.
I'm the mother of a vaccine-injured child from 17 years ago. Yeah. And so let me just, I'm sorry, I'm gonna be crying right now. The Mama Bear Army has been waiting for you all. Welcome. Glad you're here. Yeah. So going back that long ago with vaccines, what can be done to take down the 1986 Act?
Well, you know, we're going to take it down, okay? Let's just be clear about that. We're going to take it down no matter what. We got to take down that act. And that needs to be on the agenda until it's over. So, you know, all of the parents of the vaccine injured, I mean, there's such a weird dynamic going on because that was so hidden for so long. And it just didn't get the attention it deserved, and the press covered it up. And I don't think the world realized what all was going on, how bad the suppression was. But now they've applied it to all this other stuff. So this the bad news is it took so long, and it took this horrible situation. But the good news is I think we're waking up our country again to what we are and what we're about. And it's not about not providing compensation if somebody sacrificed for the overall greater good, right? So we need to have compensation, we need to have studies, we need to understand what's happening, and we need to have it needs to be a national priority. And we need to hold our candidates accountable to make that a national priority. So that's where I am. Oh, it's
repeat the question because yeah,
legally what can be done to take it down? Listen, we have to have political change. I'm sorry. This is a long battle, but it's always law, politics, and media. Those are our three elements. We got an organization, you guys, right? And we are building an army of people. Unfortunately, we're building an army of people who've lost loved ones in the hospitals. We're building an army of vaccine injured. There's enough people there to make a real difference. It doesn't, and we are committed. We are committed to doing this. So we're going to get there. So legally, we need to continually challenge these things. Mary can probably talk much better than I about the long effort over that. And then, I don't think, Mary, that there's been the constitutionality of that act has been brought into question. Go ahead, put Mary on the mic real quick, I'm sorry.
Let me just add a little bit. So one of the priorities right now for Children's Health Defense is really putting focus on the 86 Act, Kelly. And we are gonna take it down, right? This level of liability protection under the 86 Act, which was sort of the prototype, and then the 2005 PREP Act, all of this disappears when that's gone. There's not the political will right now in Congress, but there are political actors out there, including our chairman on leave, who are making this an issue. There are cases, when it has been challenged, the 86 Act has been challenged legally. What they've said is ultimately these cases go to judges who are under the Constitution, Article 3 judges. So that's their lie, but there's so many deprivations of due process. It is so full of fraud that it doesn't work at all. So we're about to file a case. CHD is supporting a case that's really about fraud in the omnibus autism proceeding, which we know, basically, the Department of Justice absolutely, 100% provably knew that vaccines caused autism when the Court of Federal Claims and then the Court of Appeals for the Federal Circuit ruled, based on what DOJ put in front of them, that, oh, there's no connection between vaccines and autism. And that was the basis for then the Supreme Court's decision in Bruce versus Wyeth and a lot of the fraud that's happened since. Also, I want to say one other case that I'm excited about. So we're about to file one that challenges the omnibus autism proceeding. Another one that I'm really excited about that we're supporting is about the HPV vaccine. So the human papillomavirus vaccine that is now recommended to all children basically worldwide and adults up to age 45, it is based on fraud, provable fraud in the clinical trials. And I co-authored a book, you can buy it over in the booth, The HPV Vaccine on Trial, Seeking Justice for a Generation Betrayed. So we're supporting litigation. It's in federal court in North Carolina now. It's multi-district litigation. It's against Merck for Gardasil. We have hundreds of plaintiffs who had to go through the vaccine injury compensation program first. When they get out of that, they go right into federal civil court. And again, they're on the ropes. If we can prove fraud, they're done. That's Merck. That's one of the big four pharma companies. And there's punitive damages under the 1986 Act if you can prove that they perpetrated a fraud on the regulator, which they did, right? They lied to the FDA in the clinical trial information. So please don't despair. As Warner said, it is a long game. They didn't set this up overnight. They didn't set up COVID overnight. It was decades in the making. And, you know, we knew that they were suppressing vaccine injury. Most people didn't know. And so we have to join in and get to that tipping point, and we're not as far away as we may imagine.
Do we have good people in this conference? What do I tell you? Last question, and then a couple of announcements.
So one of my frustrations through the pandemic, talking to like local council members and the mayor of my small town in Connecticut, was the sense we're following the guidance. End of story. There was like no more debate about pushing back on things. So my question is, I don't know, it feels like some point everybody treated guidance as law.
Well, I'm going to address that. We just addressed that early in the process. And what we found is the guidance was bribery. So federal money was used in all of our, like the contractor that I told you with the $1 million bonus. Well, it was also given to schools and cities. When you took that CARES Act money, you agreed by contract, not law, but contract, you contracted to follow the guidance. The guidance has no force except for the contract. Okay. And the government agencies, the companies, they all thought, ooh, we can't violate the contract. That's why they were so resistant. And we needed to crack that. It took a minute for us to learn about all these contracts, but that's what was happening. That's why they stared at you with blank stares. The attorneys on the other side were saying, oh my God, you better follow their guidance or you're gonna have to give all that hundreds of millions of dollars back. Mm-hmm. I mean, our school system in Akron got $250 million from the government for the COVID thing. $250 million, 20,000 students, $250 million. Are you kidding me? And no wonder they were going with the program, right? Well, I got news for you, and I said this to school boards. We went around the state of Ohio talking to school boards and school board meetings, and it said in the contract, it says, you must follow CDC guidance to the extent practicable. So their lawyers are saying, oh, you gotta do everything you can to follow the guidance. I'm coming in and telling the school board, to the extent practicable. Well, it's impracticable to violate the Constitution at the state level, the US level, every other level. That's impracticable, and you're gonna have a problem here because we're gonna sue you over that, whether it's practicable or not. So, you know, that was my position, and I thought that was a defensible position. Jeremy may not agree. I don't know. What do you think, Jeremy? But, you know, to the extent practicable, use their words against them. Parse those contracts out. But we didn't even understand what all this was doing. Right. This CARES Act funding just it ramrodded all this stuff through. And this is just money they printed. It's our money that they printed against us. and then used and weaponized against us. You know, the other thing they weaponized is the weaponization of compassion. They weaponized compassion by convincing everybody grandma was going to die, that little Billy was going to get the teacher sick. So they weaponized compassion. We need to understand these structures and systems and forms and framing so that we don't fall into the frame.
So I was asking the question more forward thinking. So in the future, should this happen again? You FOIA?
Oh yeah, we know.
Contracts.
No.
What I'm essentially asking is like, how can I in my little local community stop the madness if it flares up again?
You know? Well, I'm hoping that all of us are building allies within our communities. I mean, you know, we have got to pay attention to local governments because they have a huge ability to push back. If they're willing to. Our police force pushed back in Akron. I happen to represent the FOP. But the police said, they came out with this crazy thing that you couldn't have more than 5 people together at Thanksgiving. I think that was that 2021? And I'm like, I got 23 people invited to my family. You know? And we had a debate about it, actually, at the Bar Association on Zoom. And everybody called me a Trumper after that. But but our police union head, who we work with, he came up and said, you know, to the city that passed this stupid law, good luck enforcing it. You know, he totally, you know, was insubordinate. He didn't get fired over it. But we need to have people like that who'll stand up in our communities. And he did, thank God. Yeah.
Warner Mendenhall.